You are listening to Different Bits, A Bite of Art After the News. Our guest tonight is Tad Hirsch, researcher and PhD candidate at MIT's Media Lab, where his work focuses on the intersections between art, activism, and technology. He has worked at Motorola's Advanced Concept Group in the Interaction Design Studio at Carnegie Mellon University and has several years' experience in nonprofit management. Tad is also a frequent collaborator with the Institute for Applied Autonomy, well known here in San Francisco, and an award-winning arts collective that exhibits throughout the United States and Europe. Welcome, Tad.
Hey.
Would you like to fill in any gaps that I missed there in the introduction?
That was perfect.
Right off the web. So you are fairly well known around here, I would say, for the TextMob project.
Right.
Do you want to start off by talking about TextMob and we'll get that out of the way?
Sure.
So what is TextMob?
Excuse me if I cough a lot during this discussion. TextMob is a sort of a cell phone text messaging broadcast service. It's a tool that was developed specifically for people who were protesting at both the Democratic and Republican conventions this past summer, and then was used in the Ukraine by activists during the Orange Revolution, and then again during the inauguration of George Bush in January. And so the basic idea is that it makes it easy to send messages to groups of people, text messages to groups of people's cell phones. So, you know, you can, for example, if you're at a street demonstration and you see, like, hordes of police moving down Fifth Avenue or something very quickly, you can send a message that will then get shared to, you know, a couple hundred of your closest friends who are elsewhere in the city, so you can sort of have a sense of what's going on during street demos.
And how did you get involved with the project?
Well, the project was initially developed by the Institute for Applied Autonomy, which, as you know, is an anonymous art, activism, and technology group. And they developed it sort of first working closely with organizers in Boston who were arranging protests for the Democratic Convention. The first version of TextMob launched a few days before the Democratic Convention.
Mm-hmm.
They then went to New York and worked with, I think, a half a dozen different collectives to sort of revamp the system and to make some changes based on, you know, how things were going to be unfolding for the Republican Convention. It was used by, I think, about 6,000 or 7,000 activists during the Republican Convention. And then sort of after that, there was a decision to kind of hand it off to me for sort of further development so that the IAA could get on to doing new projects. they're sort of more interested in coming up with, like, new innovative solutions rather than
maintaining,
you know, like,
the old ones,
sticking with something for a long amount of time kind of mm-hmm. thing.
And how did it end up being used in Ukraine?
A group called Zaraz.org, which is sort of a clearinghouse for progressive issues in Kiev, contacted me, and they had, I guess, had read about TextMob on indie media, and so they were interested in using it for, you know, their actions in the Ukraine, and so, you know, we had to make some changes so that it would be compatible with the Ukrainian cell phone service networks, and then we added a few more features just that would be useful for them, and so then they were able to use it for a few weeks in November.
And how was usage different, or did people use it differently at all in Ukraine than they did here in the U.S.?
It was used differently in the sense that it wasn't, I think one of the big differences between, say, the, you know, an event like the Republican Convention and, what was going on in the streets of Kiev was that, you know, what you had in Ukraine was a kind of protest that was in some ways more spontaneous and also in some ways was less contentious.
Mm-hmm.
It was more akin to the kinds of demonstrations, for example, that you had in the Philippines in 2000 or that you had in Italy, sort of more recently, where it's, you know, there's sort of like a large public event happens, in election fraud, for example, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, like, kind of take to the streets, and then there's this sort of sense of, like, waiting for justice to happen, right?
Mm.
You've got this crowd in the street, and they're sort of, like, sharing, the kinds of messages they're sending is more just, like, you know, news accounts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in the Ukraine with TextMob, a lot of the messages just simply had to do with, like, as developments were going on inside the Ukrainian parliament, people would sort of, you know, share that kind of, like, news with their colleagues in the street. With the Republican Convention, it's very different because there it's much more of a, you know, like, really kind of like ongoing almost street battles between protesters and police. And so you get much more of a tactical kind of use.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, during the Republican Convention, people were sharing news information, but there also was very kind of like, as I said, like tactical information. So, for example, alerting protesters about police movements, telling people or reporting spotting delegates. So if they happen to see, there's one message that was sent out, somebody saw a group of delegates sit down for brunch at this restaurant, so they sent a message out, and by the time that group had paid the check, there was like a couple hundred protesters outside waiting for them. So, it's a different kind of usage, I think, in when you've got these like massively decentralized kinds of protests, mm-hmm. than you see in the more traditional sort of gatherings.
Do you imagine TextMob will remain sort of an activist's tool, or do you see it filtering out for other uses?
Well, it'll do both. I mean, it already has filtered out for other uses. Since it launched, it's been just available, as a free service to anyone who wants to use it. There's already, like, it ranges from, people who are trying to, coordinate parties to groups of people that are just kind of like sharing small poems in SMS to, there was, I think, groups of people who were like, going to Las Vegas for somebody's wedding and like using it to kind of coordinate. So there's that kind of use that's been evolving. While at the same time, it definitely has its roots in activism, right? So, in New York, critical mass, it's been used for critical mass a number of times, and for smaller actions. And so, I suspect it's going to just wind up getting used for a whole range of things. I mean, what we're sort of doing with it right now is, continuing to offer it to people who want to use it, but we're also working with a guy from OpenFlows and from Interactivist to fully document the code and then get it out as an open source release so that anyone can just take it and set up their own service and do whatever they want with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was speaking with one of my co-hosts from the news show earlier, Mark. He's working right now on integrating the TextMob into our indie media site here in San Francisco. Yeah, so we can send our text messages and have them pop right up on the website.
That's great.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Cool.
So, I'm thinking TextMob really relies on this very sort of decentralized, emergent model of communication, which a lot of people see as a sort of a new paradigm in terms of how we look at nature and society right now. What do you think about that?
Yeah, but it's not quite. I mean, it's sort of a hybrid thing, TextMob is at least.
Mm-hmm.
The really decentralized communication is what goes on, when you get people sort of just sending messages to their friends who then send them on to their friends and so forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
What TextMob was doing was trying to sort of provide a bridge between the more traditional forms of protest communication where you've got, sort of like a small group of organizers who have information that people think is pretty reliable and are sort of, traditionally would be the ones in the streets with a bullhorn, trying to find a bridge between that model and this more sort of viral model of communication, right? Because the problem with the viral model is that it can be really difficult to connect with people who are not already part of your social network, right? And so when you're talking about sort of large street actions where you've got lots and lots of people there, you want some way, and particularly if you're not trying to have like one sort of rally or one march, but you want, thousands of people doing actions all over a city at the same time, you need some way that they can sort of communicate with each other quickly. And so what TextMob was trying to do is provide a way that those people could kind of meet each other, to bring a little bit of sort of order to viral communications or something like that. So it's just kind of like weird hybrid, and I'm curious to see sort of where, how that evolves, if it winds up moving more towards one kind of use or towards another. More generally on this question of decentralization, I mean, that was the sort of the big lesson from Seattle 99 was that, this idea of these sort of swarming protests, which is the Defense Department and the Rand Corporation, when they analyze protests, which, you know, frankly, they do a much better job of than we do a lot of times. They use this term swarming to describe this phenomena where you have, you know, large numbers of loosely coordinated actors kind of like converging on a central point, right, and overwhelming it. And that's kind of what happened with Seattle with the WTO protests. What's interesting, you know, about the approach that was taken in New York was there was an attempt to, you know, sort of like push it one step further and say, look, we're not even going to have a single, you know, target that we're all just going to try and kind of jam, but rather, you know, can we really effectively disperse and diffuse dissent all over the city and essentially transform the entire city into kind of a platform for resistance? And, you know, I mean, it's an attractive model because it's really hard to defend against. Mm-hmm. The police necessarily are going to always be playing catch-up in that kind of model because things are so spontaneous and that, you know, they just can't really get a handle on it all. But it's really, it becomes a huge organizing challenge, right, to keep it from just being this totally kind of diffuse day where, you know, you only have sort of groups of twos and threes doing small actions that are not terribly successful and that no one notices and people get arrested and that kind of thing. So, I mean, you know, I don't know to what extent, you know, that sort of becomes the dominant model. I don't know. I mean, again, you can contrast it with, you know, the kinds of demonstrations that have been going on in Lebanon, which are, you know, they're much more traditional model. They're highly centralized. It's, you know, tens of thousands of people going to a particular place in order to express themselves. And in, you know, in that context, it's incredibly, or it seems to be really, really powerful and really effective. And so, you know, I don't know, I think my sense of things is that, you know, as organizers, you know, we maintain kind of an array of tools that we can use in different kinds of situations and contexts. And that, you know, as we move forward, I think the answer is going to be, like, you know, having the broadest collection of those tools as we can and, you know, sort of like using them selectively rather than saying one model is going to be the correct one versus another, something like that.
That's interesting. Do you see any other models sort of that we haven't tried out yet here in the U.S. that might be coming down the pipeline?
I don't know well, the first thing is if I did have a new model, I'm not sure I'd want to say anything about it until it was tried. but I think more accurate, I'm not sure that I'd say that there's a new model that, you know, that I'm aware of that's been tried elsewhere that we haven't done here. And in fact, I think what I'm sort of more attracted to are actually older models that, you know, we sort of seem to have, that maybe are coming back, right? I'm thinking of stuff like the No Business as Usual protests from the 80s and the Stop the City movement, again, from the 80s, you know, which are largely UK-based, I think, but also had expression in the U.S. And you know, and there was, again, this sort of notion of, you know, sort of lots and lots of people doing in widely decentralized actions as a way of exercising you know, people power in a city. To me, that's really compelling if it can be pulled off effectively. And, you know, one of the other things that's maybe, you know, sort of like worth thinking about is, you know, one of the problems, for example, you know, with like, you know, protests that you see at the Republican convention or anti-WTO events or something like that is that, you know, you're picking these protests in response to a highly symbolically charged event of you know, capital and power, right? Mm-hmm. So the Republicans announced they're going to have a convention, and so our response is that we're going to have a demonstration. You know, and the problem is that in that context, the state is prepared and willing to spend lots and lots of resources to control the environment, right? So, right. You know, for example, the Democratic Convention here in Boston, the Boston Police Department got, you know, huge federal funds to be spent on surveillance equipment and non-lethal technology, right? Because there was this thing coming. What happens, though, if you know, if we sort of decouple the demonstration from the state event. Like, what, you know, what happens when you just sort of arbitrarily pick a date and say this will be the date where we will go and organize one of these large events? You know, I'm curious to know, like, how that can maybe sort of change the dynamic a little bit, right? And I'm thinking about, like, the, you know, the June 18th demos, which were, what, 2001, I think, or something like that, you know, where you had the City of London effectively shut down on a date that didn't have the same kind of really obvious symbolic power to it. So that, you know, to me, that's an interesting kind of avenue to start exploring.
Would that be, would we be attempting to keep the authorities from knowing that the protest was going to happen at all?
Yeah, I mean, sure, you always can attempt that. You always fail. I mean, we'll see. You know, again, it depends on the kind of action, right? I mean, if you want, if it's an action that requires 10,000, 100,000 people, it's going to be really hard to not let word get out about it. Right. If it's a smaller action, you know, more like direct action kinds of stuff where you're looking at something that maybe a handful of committed activists are going to pull off, in that case, it's going to be really, you know, it's a lot simpler to keep it quiet. So, you know, again, I mean, I think the issue there is about trying to strike the balance of, you know, controlling as much information as you can, but also not being naive and assuming that you've done a good job of controlling the information. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, this was a huge, this came up with the text mob stuff a lot too, where it's like, look, you know, we do what we can to protect those communications, but the assumption that is made is that it's all being monitored. Uh-huh. And you just try to, you know, sort of like act accordingly to that.
That was sort of my next question was, what are your thoughts on the monitoring of the messages? What are your thoughts on the monitoring of the messages? I mean, how much of it do you think actually is monitored or?
Well, you know, it depends. I mean, again, if excuse me, if it's, you know, if you're using a tool that is, you know, pretty publicly known that it as an activist tool, and you're using it during the Republican convention, that's a little more high profile than just sending messages to your friends on a, you know, any given Tuesday or something like
right.
that. You know, during the Republican convention, I would say that there were the public channels, the ones that anyone could just sign up for, you know, you have to assume those are definitely being monitored, like in real time. There's police officers potentially just receiving those messages the same time you are.
Sure.
The other ones that, you know, were more selective, like, you know, we had, with TextMob, you can set up groups in a number of different ways. You can make them just open to anyone. You can make them invitation only so that you have to actually invite people to join your group, or you can make them sort of approval-based. And so with the latter two, there's a little more control. And so, you know, with those, probably a reasonable assumption is that, you know, depending on how tight you are, the list moderators are in controlling access, they may have a better expectation of privacy, at least in terms of, like, real-time snooping. Like, chances may be that you can keep the police from listening in as a message is sent. However, you know, we're totally reliant on, you know, these sort of corporate communication structures, which means that that message traffic does exist somewhere on a corporate server and that the police or anyone else, you know, with a subpoena, with a set of high-powered lawyers, potentially has access to it. The flip side of that, though, is that because, you know, that record exists in a place like Verizon or T-Mobile, who has a vested interest in protecting their customers' privacy, I actually suspect that in some ways it's not a bad thing because, you know, the police can't just, like, strong-arm their way in. Right, it's not the same as if they're gonna, you know, do a raid on like an indie media server in the UK and like snatch all the machines, right, and then just start going through them. I mean, if they want to try that with a place like T-Mobile, they're gonna have to contend with an extremely aggressive and extremely well-funded legal department, and you know that is a line of defense, and so you know it gets a little complicated.
You know, I'm just sort of listening to what you're saying. It seems like a lot of this is leaning towards spontaneous action.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen much of that happen yet? Because I know that most of the protests, at least around San Francisco, seem like they're, you know, require huge amounts of forethought and planning and all of this coordination. But maybe that's not the way to go. Maybe that's the wrong approach.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure it's an either or kind of thing, right? So, you know, for example, during the Republican convention, during the convergence, you know, you had lots and lots of small spontaneous actions going on. For example, you know, friends of mine were in Herald Square, rather, on August 31st, which was like the big day of action. And, you know, there was huge police presence and lots of protesters. And everyone knew that there was going to be something happening, but no one knew exactly what. And frankly, there wasn't a specific thing that was planned. And, you know, and so these guys, you know, found themselves on this one street, and they saw a bunch of delegate buses heading towards them, and so they just kind of like, you know, quickly decided, okay, we're going to try and take the street right now. And they, you know, sort of ran out into the street and put on Abu Ghraib hoods and sort of just kneeled in the street and managed to actually hold it for, you know, I forget, 10, 15, 20 minutes, something like that, right? Mm. And so, you know, it was certainly within the context of this much broader, highly planned, highly anticipated action, but this specific action itself was really spontaneous and was, you know, and was effective. So there's that kind of thing. I mean, you know, the other side too is like, you know, very sort of small scale kinds of acts of resistance, right? Which, you know, range from like graffitiing stuff to, you know, just sort of going out and handing out, you know, subversive flyers or whatever to people on the street. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, there's this whole range of like artistic practice, which is increasingly kind of interested in, you know, the sort of like disruption of everyday kind of experience, right? And so, you know, I think it's this question of like, to me, it gets interesting when these various tactics just kind of converge, right? And so you're just kind of like pulling from every technique that we have at our disposal, and just trying to like, you know, sort of reconfigure them in innovative and interesting ways.
Well, that's interesting. Let's move on to Speakeasy for a minute.
Okay.
Can you explain the concept behind that project?
Sure, yeah. switching gears now.
Completely.
So Speakeasy is it's actually another cell phone-based project, but the idea here is trying to improve access to services and information for new immigrants. In particular, I've been working with a group in Boston's Chinatown, a group called the Asian Community Development Corporation. And they're, you know, like a grassroots community development group that works with a population that's predominantly Asian, largely Chinese, and a mix of experience from, you know, people who've been living, you know, who are legal residents, you know, were born and raised in the United States, families have been here for a few generations, on the one hand, to, on the other hand, you know, people who've recently arrived are often sort of don't have full legal status, you know, and are living in sort of like this inner city working class neighborhood. And so the big challenge, particularly for that latter group, is A, you know, even if you're undocumented, you do have some legal rights, and you are entitled to certain levels of social services, law enforcement, some health care, sort of a range of things. But the issue is that, you know, one, a lot of times new immigrants don't speak the language, so there's language barriers. They don't know what their rights are or what services are available, so there's knowledge barriers. And then thirdly, there are a host of, you know, there's like oftentimes real hesitancy to make your presence known if you're here illegally, right? So there's fear, and then there's cultural issues too, how comfortable someone feels in calling on city government or something like that is largely dependent on, you know, what kind of culture someone is coming out of. So what we sort of, you know, and so the traditional way that activists, grassroots activists have tried to address the problem is to sort of advocate for, you know, the city services to provide language translation or something like that, right? So, you know, for example, here in Boston, the police emergency line 911 has, you know, a host of language translations available. The bad news is you have to ask for them in English, but they're there. The problem with you know, that we found with trying to sort of just rely on local government to provide those services is that, first of all, you know, they don't do it unless they have to. It's expensive for them to do. It's complicated, and, you know, city or, you know, political officials know that new immigrants don't vote, and so they're not a serious constituency. So, you know, trying to advocate for political reform is sort of long, time-consuming, and of limited effectiveness. So what we've decided to do instead is say, look, you know, in addition to the advocacy work that groups are already doing, we wanted a solution that could kind of fill in the gaps that could be used in cases where there wasn't already language services available, and to also address these other kinds of challenges, the knowledge stuff, that kind of thing. So what we've done is recruited sort of a network of volunteers who are people who are part of the Asian community in Boston who speak, you know, English and Mandarin and Cantonese, a handful of languages, and who are familiar with social service, social services, as well as with the local economy, as well as with the informal economy, because they happen to, they live in a particular neighborhood. They live in Chinatown, so they sort of know what's available. We've got this network outfitted with cell phones, and so we have all their phone numbers. We know who is available when to take calls, and we know what languages each person speaks, and we know something about what their particular areas of expertise. And so with all that information, we've set up a single service wherein a new immigrant or anyone really can call one phone number. They answer a couple of questions that are just automated, you know, like press one for Cantonese, press two for Mandarin kind of things. And then a computer, you know, sort of matches them with a volunteer so they can talk to someone on the phone who can give them some initial information and then can also provide a referral, so can help them call, say, the Department of Motor Vehicles if they need to do that, and then can provide language interpretation right then in real time on the phone. So that's a really long-winded explanation.
It is, but
of
that's
the project.
It's good because the explanation on the website is not very explanatory.
Yeah, it needs some work. we did a pilot of this project last spring with, I think it was about 260 people for a handful of weeks, just to sort of like make sure the technology was there and to start dealing with some of the issues, which, you know, the pilot went really well. The response from the community was overwhelmingly positive. And so we're revamping some of the software right now and are looking forward to launching it for the city of Boston in the next couple of months. So that's sort of a project that's moving forward.
That's great. So technically, how does this work? So if I'm an immigrant and I need to make a phone call to the DMV, so I call your service.
Right. So what's happened? Okay. So in that scenario, what's happened already is that somebody from the ACDC or from some community development organization is already going door-to-door in the neighborhood, right, and giving out these little cards that have a phone number on them and something in your native language telling you, hey, if you need anything, call this number, okay? So, you know, let's assume you don't even know about the DMV, but you know you have a car or you're trying to buy a car and you know you need to get license plates for it or something like that. You look at the card you've been given, you call the number. It then, you know, computer answers the phone and will then ask you something like, you know, as I said, like press one for Cantonese, press two for Spanish, whatever language you need. It then may give you a list of choices like, You know, for legal assistance, press 5. For medical questions, press this. And one of those would be something like city government or motor vehicles or whatever. So you'd press that, and then you're put on hold. You get to listen to some nice little music. And the computer then goes into a database of all of our volunteers and finds someone who speaks your language, who knows about DMV kinds of issues, and who's available right now to take your call. The computer then calls that person. They answer the phone. Computer plays a message saying the speakeasy service is calling. There's someone who needs your help. And then connects those two together. So now you're talking to a volunteer in whatever your native language is. Uh-huh. You explain to them that, you know, you want to buy a car and you don't know what you have to do to make it legal. And so this person says, well, okay, you know, you buy the car and then you have to go to the Department of Motor Vehicles and, you know, fill out some forms and do all these kinds of things. And then, you know, you may say, okay, great, you know, but I have some questions, you know, about what documents I need to bring with me, and maybe, you know, you don't know the person who's helping you doesn't know the answer.
Right.
So they say, okay, well, hold on a second. Let's call the Department of Motor Vehicles right now. And so the volunteer dials in the DMV's number, and pretty soon, you know, you, the volunteer, and someone from the DMV are all talking on the phone together.
Okay, so they conference the person.
And so then the volunteer can kind of translate back and forth for you so that you can ask questions directly of the DMV and they can give you answers and that kind of thing.
It's a great idea.
How did
the pilot go? And how did the springtime pilot go? Was it what you expected?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it was sort of what we expected, and then a bunch of surprises. it went well. The technology held up reasonably well, which was nice to see. We're making some changes to it now. Most importantly, we're going to an all voice over internet solution, so VoIP services, which is means that all of the phone calls will be managed through the internet, which is nice because it's free.
Mm-hmm.
Or close to free, and it also means that we can connect people across, you know, huge distances if we want with no real additional cost. The people who used it really liked it, and you know, were just really, really excited about the idea. And what was cool about it was that, you know, that excitement was coming from both ends. So we had a group of people who, you know, didn't really speak English and were sort of new arrivals to Boston, and they were really excited about it because, you know, they on a daily basis run into these situations where they are, you know, needing some assistance and don't really have a good way to get it. And so, you know, they'll do things like ask strangers to help them with language and that kind of thing. So they were really excited about it. But the other piece of it that was really inspiring was that a lot of the, you know, the potential volunteers were also really excited about it because, you know, for these guys, it was like a way that they could, you know, give back to the community and a way that they could stay engaged with their community, you know, which is like really hard to do for a lot of people. If you're working a job and you're raising kids or whatever, you know, there's just not that much time. And you know, it's also one of these things where, like, you may live in a particular neighborhood and that's where you identify, but you have a job, which means you have to travel somewhere else. And so, you know, the kinds of, like, community ties that, you know, really provide meaning to city residents, you know, get stretched really thin by the pressures of money and the pressures of family and all these kinds of things. And so what we heard back from a lot of our volunteers is that the fact that they could do this thing, they could be involved with it, you know, wherever they were, you know, because it was all just cell phones, and that they could do it sort of like in these small increments as needed to make, you know, to take a single phone call, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
They found that really exciting. And so, you know, what we're hoping is that in addition to providing this sort of like an, you know, immediate kind of service of helping, you know, helping overcome some language barriers and that sort of thing, is that a project like this can actually lead to this you know, longer-term kind of developmental goal of creating stronger sense of community involvement among all of the residents of the neighborhood, right? And that becomes hugely powerful because, you know, that's the kind of social capital that ultimately forms the basis for political power and social power. And, you know, again, particularly for working class, minority communities, like, this is huge. And so, so it was really exciting. And so, you know, we're eager to move forward with it.
It is exciting. How can people get involved with the
with that project?
Yeah.
Probably the easiest thing is, so you know, first step would be to go to the project website for that one, which is just www.3-way.org. And there's some, as you say, there's some information on the site, although it may not be adequate, but I'll work on that. And there's also, I think, contact information on that site as well.
Okay, great. So before we run out of time, I do want to talk to you about IC, which is my personal favorite project.
So, so should I describe it?
Please do. Go for it.
Okay, I'll try to be quicker this time. So IC is a service for both. Well, it's a web-based service that allows people to avoid surveillance cameras, basically. So you come to a website and you see a map of your city, and on the map are all of the surveillance cameras that are looking at public space. And then simply by clicking on that map, you can plot routes that avoid as many of those cameras as possible. That's sort of like the basic idea. And that was launched for the city of New York in October of 2001, so 1 month after the September 11th attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, it's been done for Amsterdam as well as for Ljubljana, Slovenia. And the project has evolved a bit, too, so that in addition to being on the web, it also runs, there's a client that runs on PDA-type devices, so as you're walking around the city with, if you have like a Palm Pilot or you know, like in our case, it's a Compaq or whatever, some Linux-based portable device, you can, you know, do your route planning, but you also can do data entry. So if you see cameras around you, you can look them up on the map and get some information about them, who owns them, that kind of thing. Or if they're not on the map, you can enter them. And so using that tool, we've then done these sort of camera mapping workshops to help sort of privacy advocates, you know, both do outreach, sort of like raising awareness about surveillance issues, but also to start creating some useful data. You know, one of the things that's so funny about the way cameras have gotten deployed, particularly in the United States, is that there's not like a sort of large centralized agency that's deploying them, right?
Right.
I mean, until very recently, it wasn't really the police doing it. Now that's changing in places like Chicago and in Boston and in D.C. But, you know, it was largely just sort of like individual business owners or building owners putting cameras up on their property, largely because they get, you know, insurance breaks for doing that. It was just this kind of like infrastructure that was sort of evolving with no real discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really wasn't possible to get an answer to a question like, well, how many cameras are in New York City in 2001? Like, you actually couldn't know. There was no way to know that other than to have, you know, groups of citizens, groups of civilians, groups of regular people who are concerned about privacy to go out and actually, you know, look around and mark down where they were. And so, you know, we're certainly not the first group to do that. The New York Civil Liberties Union did some of that in 1998. A group called the Surveillance Camera Players has been doing it for a number of years, too. What we were adding to that effort was the ability to take the data that these privacy advocates were gathering and have it available in a useful format, like standard GIS data format, so that you could then start overlaying it on top of other kinds of information.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you can take a map of the city, and you can lay on top of it the locations of all the surveillance cameras, and then you can lay on top of that economic indicators, right? So why is it that cameras are clustered in all of these places of high economic value, like business districts, when if you then lay on top of that crime data, it turns out that most of the street crime that they're trying to prevent happens in working class neighborhoods, right? And so you start to see these really interesting kind of relationships between the technologies of control and the interests that they're actually supporting. And it's not the ones that are, it's not necessarily the same as the sort of kinds of things, the kinds of rhetorics that are used to justify them, right? I mean, when you talk about surveillance, the kinds of things people talk about are preventing kidnapping and murder or whatever. And in practice, what they get used for largely is trying to deter vandalism, right? These are two very different categories of crime. Mm-hmm. And the kinds of people who care about the one are not always as concerned with the latter kind of thing. So I got long-winded again, but that's the project.
No, that's quite all right. So these maps were actually, of all the data was accumulated by people, by hand,
yeah.
Walking around.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
The only way to do it.
That's incredible.
No, we'll see what happens. I mean, if you look at, like, the UK, for example, which has far more extensive video surveillance than we do, there it is the police. And so, you know, the police go in and they put in these networks of cameras, and it's... the police are the ones, well, the police contract out for people to monitor those cameras. And so they can tell you where all of their cameras are, right, because they keep records of that. And we're starting to get some of that here, like I said. I mean, Chicago, you know, has a new program they're recently deploying. Boston's got a brand new program that they're just starting. Washington, D.C.'s got a program. And so that's starting to happen here. But even then, you know, there's so many cameras that are out there that the police ones are really just a small fraction. And so, you know, there is absolutely no way to keep track of this infrastructure unless individuals are going to go out and do it themselves. And it just has to be a grassroots effort. It's the only way it's going to get done. But what, you know, the thing that's sort of interesting to keep in mind about this stuff is, like, although the cameras are generally put in place by individuals, over time, the data that comes from those cameras winds up getting kind of tied together. What we're starting to see now are private companies offering to do camera monitoring for you, right? So if you put up a camera in your building, you know, rather than just having that data go to a VCR or something in your basement, you can now contract out with some security company, which will transmit all that data wirelessly to some central location that they have, where they're monitoring hundreds of cameras from hundreds of different locations around the city, right? And so what's happening is it is turning into infrastructure, and it is the hardware, the pieces of cameras are put there first, and then later all of the information, that's the data that's getting drawn from them, is getting tied together and centralized and is accessible. And again, it's, you know, it's this kind of thing that's just kind of, it's just sort of happening in a sort of piece-by-piece basis. It's largely being driven by the market. And, you know, if we're going to have any kind of public discussion or debate about this, it's only going to happen because grassroots efforts are going to be made to force that mm-hmm. debate.
Yeah, actually, as far as the police enforce, or, you know, the police-oriented cameras, they did recently start a new program out here in the Bay Area,
right,
as well. And I mean, I can't say I've heard much discussion happening about it. I mean, certainly not a lot of questioning, more just, you know, people being enthusiastic about crime prevention and that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, it's a complicated issue. Like, you know, I'm starting a project right now, again, with this group in Chinatown, because the Boston Police Department, you know, just announced that they're going to deploy a network of surveillance cameras into the Chinatown neighborhood, right? And the interesting sort of backstory is that these are cameras that they purchased for the Democratic Convention, because they got money to do that. And so then, you know, they've got these things sitting around, so they have to figure out what to do with them. And so they're going to deploy them into Chinatown. You know, the important thing is that the majority of residents of Chinatown are not against this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they think it's great. However, you have to push a little bit further to understand, like, why that is. The general perception among people who live in Chinatown is that they have serious crime problems and that the police aren't doing anything about it.
Right.
So, you know, they see these cameras as an indication that the police are going to be active in their neighborhood, and they're very supportive of that idea, right? They have real crime, and they're very concerned about it, and they want the police to be involved. However, you know, there's a lot of questions that are going to kind of come up as this program moves forward about what impact, if any, they're having on crime, To what extent are these cameras standing in for police officers on the street? I mean, one of the reasons that police departments are attracted to this technology is that it's relatively cheap,
mm-hmm.
right? You put a camera up and, yeah, you have to pay someone $7 an hour or whatever to sit and watch it, but that's a lot less than you have to pay, you know, a police officer to actually, like, patrol, right?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I mean, for all of the resources
automated.
That we're directing towards Homeland Security, you know, a lot of the funding for that stuff is coming out of local law enforcement, which is like the great irony, right? So in order to make ourselves more secure, we're taking all the resources away from public safety, which is like an amazing way to do this stuff. So police, you know, police departments are strapped for cash, and so they're looking at this as a reasonable kind of solution. And, you know, as someone who's sort of more concerned with the community side of it, it raises a lot of real concerns about, like, again, okay, let's suppose, you know, you announce this program, you get everyone's expectations, you know, really revved up that, oh, finally there's going to be something in our neighborhood, we're going to see crime rates drop, it's going to be great, and then 6 months down the road, the cameras are there and crime rates don't drop.
Mm-hmm.
What does that do? I mean, obviously, if you haven't made the impact on crime, you know, have you made an impact on public perception, right? I mean, if you've got a neighborhood where people are already distrustful of the police, does this program help or hurt?
Right.
And I think there's these sort of more subtle kinds of questions about, you know, the long-term impact of this particular approach to public safety that we frankly don't know the answers to. And more importantly, if we, meaning, you know, neighborhood groups and grassroots activists, if we are not going to be out there really kind of like leading on these issues, they're not going to get addressed. Because there's, you know, we're the only ones that are going to be in a position to start raising these questions.
It's also interesting to see how this fits into this larger scheme of, you know, increasingly automated
mm-hmm.
crime prevention techniques and
yeah.
like the system in the Bay Area. You know, it's mainly an automatic system where the microphone and supposedly, you know, is listening for gunshots
right.
and making people aware of that, and then how that fits in with facial recognition technology and that
yeah.
kind of thing. I mean, it's a little scary.
It is scary, but, you know, again, I think the point that I keep wanting to make with that stuff is that it's scary, but it's scary for more than the obvious reasons. It's not just scary because it's a privacy issue, and it's not just scary because it's a civil liberties issue. It's also scary because we don't know that it actually works.
Mm-hmm.
And more than that, it's also scary because, you know, in my hypothesis is that the way that you do public safety, the way that the methods that you choose to fight crime will have impacts on the way people perceive their neighborhoods,
mm-hmm.
the way they perceive their relationship to power, and the way they perceive themselves, and that ultimately the actual crime rates are important, but they're not as important as the way people feel about their neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
right? If people, it doesn't matter what is happening in terms of crime, if people are scared, then you have real negative impacts on neighborhood life. People don't go outside, right? And that winds up having a much deeper impact in terms of the community health, in terms of the economics of the neighborhood, and it just kind of like it's that becomes hugely important to the life of a community. And, you know, one of these questions that you have to start asking is like, look, when we're putting all these technologies in the neighborhood and they're all very public and they all have this great presence, you know, what message are we sending? I mean, are we convincing ourselves that we live in dangerous places that need this kind of surveillance? Are we convincing ourselves that it's not safe to go outside? And, you know, to the extent that we're doing that, I think we're causing real harm. And to the extent that we're doing that without real justification is, to me, like, you know, that's where it starts getting really scary and really stupid.
And, of course, the neighborhoods that receive this generous technology are the ones that are already being targeted and
I mean, they're the most vulnerable ones. Absolutely. But again, you know, from an activist standpoint, like, it's really important to keep in mind that for a lot of people living in these neighborhoods, they're, you know, this is good stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, because end of the day, safety trumps liberty, civil liberties for a lot of people. You know, it's like if you tell me, okay, I got to give up some privacy, but my kids can walk to school.
Right.
You know, most people are going to take that, definitely. And so I think the challenge for activists is to try to move beyond just arguing about privacy,
mm-hmm.
but to really understand what is the sort of the whole scope of the threat to neighborhood life, and to be able to to be able to convey that in terms that are meaningful to the residents of these neighborhoods.
That's a very good point.
Thank you.
One last question here. I'm kind of curious because, you know, your work is obviously very subversive and you work in, you're working in a large institution.
Yeah.
I'm curious what the reaction is and sort of what response you get from people around you and the institution and that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, the institution here is supportive of this work, which is really wonderful, you know, and, you know, and the reaction I get has generally been really positive. I mean, you know, they provide some funding for it. They're very supportive of it. Now, you know, that's not necessarily true of academic institutions across the board. One of the reasons I came here was because that was possible. In my old job, you know, my previous experience was essentially like, you know, having day jobs and mm-hmm. doing this kind of work on the side.
Right.
Because the institutions weren't really supportive of it. You know, I mean, the challenge that someone like me faces is trying to do work that, you know, is socially meaningful and personally fulfilling, but also satisfies the requirements of technology development and academic research.
Right.
Right. And sometimes you can bring those things together. And so, for example, a project like TextMob, you can do it because you're using, you know, text messaging. It's relatively new technology. And so it's something innovative and people are excited about that. And you can do it. You can do that and call it research in addition to providing fulfilling these other functions. You know, with other projects I've been involved with, that's absolutely not the case. You know, if I'm doing work that's, you know, much more sort of like grassroots mm-hmm. kind of organizing. For example, there's a project going on here. Well, it's not even a project, but there's a local university here is trying to put a level 4 biosafety lab, which is one that works with like the most contagious pathogens. Mm-hmm. They're trying to place this thing in the heart of Boston. And so there's community groups that are trying to organize against this. And I've been somewhat involved with that work. That's not work that I can justify as research here because it's a very traditional kind of activism.
Right.
You know, it's like going door to door, it's like getting things into the paper, it's all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's like, it's a balancing act. You know, and I think the thing that is important if for those of us who are, as you say, are supported by these large institutions, but trying to do socially engaged work is, you know, to just always be very aware of our own complicity,
mm-hmm.
right? And to, you know, not hide from that. So, I work for MIT. I'm able to do socially engaged work. At the same time, MIT does a lot of work for the Defense Department.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we know this. And there's no quick solution to that.
Right.
It's the complexity of the world that we live in. And so, you know, the best I can do is be aware of that complicity, to point it out when I can, and to, you know, misdirect as many of those military dollars away from armed systems.
Money's got to come from
neighborhood
somewhere.
Programs as I can.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Is there anything we can look for coming down the pipes from you?
Yeah, probably, but I try not to talk about projects until they're actually real.
All right. Keep it a secret then. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to speak with you.
Have a good night.
You too.
Bye. All right. Well, that does it for us this evening. That was Tad Hirsch from the Media Lab talking about various subversive political art projects. And I am going to leave you tonight with a Living Sound, Patent pending. Tune in next week for Jonathan Keats, conceptual artist. Very humorous. Should be a lot of fun. Have a good night.